A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By Internet Real Audio G2, the Astra Digital Satellite System, and across the globe through AM, FM, and shortwave outlets. From Hilversum, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, the weekly survey of communications developments, produced and presented by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and it seems to be rather ordinary to be back in Hilversum after the Media Network roadshow has travelled some 40,000 kilometres over the last month. Please bear with us as we try to catch up with the post. Our web editor Andy Sennett reports a bumper crop of emails.
And we've got quite a few Christmas cards in already. I can see from the postmark that the postal services are going through their traditional slowdown period.
Maybe in January the postal service will come clean and explain whether the onslaught of email has meant more or less Christmas card traffic for the last year of the century. There may be less cards, but the mail order business via the internet is booming to more than compensate. Well, advanced warning to grab a pen and paper to send us a card in January, for a contest is coming up a little later on.
Radio Netherlands, another detour on the path to self-improvement.
I mentioned last week that we have little boxes of discs full of material collected during our South Pacific and Southeast Asia safari. We're going to mix that into the menu over the coming weeks. While I was in Sydney, Australia, I tried to check the prices on shortwave receivers for the latest edition of the receiver shopping list, now out. Whereas in Europe and the Middle East you'll find that world portables are everywhere, it was quite a safari in itself to find one in that part of Australia. Mike Bird came up for the day to Sydney to act as our media guide. And over lunch, I asked him, who needs shortwave radio in that part of the world?
I listen to it every day. I know a lot of people who listen to international radio every day. But I have to say that Australia is a country that doesn't listen to international broadcasting. You can't buy shortwave radios here readily. Whereas if you travel to New Zealand or to the Pacific or Southeast Asia, you can. Australians have always had a good radio service. Back in the early days, they had medium wave and short wave, the short wave inland service. Since the 60s and 70s, we've lost the inland short wave service.
You said that internal short wave service. Let's listen to a recording of one of the old stations in Perth.
That's Chuck Mangione and Feel So Good. News is next, followed by a sports update, and we'll have the latest update on the Kununurra murder situation. This is ABC Radio Regional. Time for news. It's 9 o'clock.
Here is the news from the ABC, read by Rachel Murray. Police.
Domestically, the first shortwave was the inland shortwave service, and you had transmitters at Brisbane and in Sydney and in just outside Melbourne at Lyndhurst, and you also had them in Wanneroo, just outside Perth. And those transmitters used to point inwards, and they used to service those inland state areas. And the farmers, the graziers, people working out back could, with a simple shortwave radio, keep in touch, know what's going on. I mean, they could find out the time and they could find out the day. Because when you're in the middle of the bush, the sun rises there and it sets over there. You have a rough estimation of time, but nothing else.
But that inland service has gone away, although it's been replaced by something else.
Yes, it's been replaced by the Northern Territory shower service. There's three transmitters. I think it's Catherine, Tennant Creek and Alice Springs. And they have three 50-kilowatt transmitters with aerials that direct the signal up to the straight up to the ionosphere. When it hits the ionosphere, it spreads and comes straight down again like a shower. And that means that everyone with a shortwave radio underneath that can tune in, listen, get very good fade-free reception.
And for that, you wouldn't use medium wave?
No, you would not use medium wave. And you get a mixture of ABC programming and local Aboriginal programming.
Is that popular?
Very popular, yes. It's cheap and simple. You can drive in your car, you can go and do your work out in the bush, and you've got the radio, and it's working.
But why, then, can't you find shortwave radio so easily in the cities, for instance? If I'm looking in the electronic shops, yes, plenty of games and things like that, but I don't see shortwave radios.
Well, Australia has used medium wave in a very big way in the last 50 or 60 years, and people have not had to rely upon shortwave. People who've migrated to this country will listen to shortwave, and still do, but your average Australian will listen to the commercials, the ABC, the SBS on medium wave, FM, and television.
I noticed, in fact, that the medium wave band isn't as full as I expected.
No, there's no congestion here. When I first arrived here from the UK back in 1981, I just couldn't believe it. A, there was no medium wave stations. You know, there was barn doors between them on the dial. And secondly, on shortwave, there was no such thing as interference, no congestion. I mean, you can listen around signals in Australia.
But you like living here?
Oh, it's a wonderful country. Great weather, great people, outside style of living, great wine, fabulous wine. I mean, you know... But no, Australians are very affable, very easy to get along with. If I had to sum up Australia, it's very much in-your-face type country. You know, everything's in your face.
What about the way Australia projects itself to other parts of the Pacific or indeed other parts of the world? I mean, you've worked in the past for Radio Australia. It's a very different Radio Australia on the air now.
Yes, it's a very sad situation. Radio Australia was cut back by about 50% about 2 or 3 years ago. And basically only has Shepparton and Brandon to broadcast into the Pacific. Well, the Keating government closed down Carnarvon, and then the Howard government closed down Darwin, but they've mothballed it and kept it running. It's actually currently being looked after by British Aerospace, and actually was also testing a few weeks ago. But Australia, or should I say this government, does not see the need for broadcasting into Asia. I believe that this Howard government is very keen to promote commercial deals with Asian countries. This present government was in opposition for 13 years. In that 13 years, it felt that it was dealt a very bad deal by the ABC. So I believe there's a bit of a personal vendetta there. They see closing of Darwin as a way of getting back to the ABC. We need Darwin more than ever. I mean, Radio Australia is having to use Taiwan to transmit into West Indonesia, but at the moment it's basically a Pacific Island broadcaster, Papua New Guinea, and it can still get up to Japan as well. It needs a high profile in this area, as we've seen in the last few weeks with the East Timor situation. It needs to get a loud signal into the area, not only for East Timorese, but also for the people who live in Jakarta.
So there's still that role of international broadcasting, improving an information flow.
I think so. I think it's very important. It's a very cheap medium. Of course, when we get digital shortwave, it'll be much higher quantity and much more reliable. I and many people cannot understand why the government keep it closed. If they were going to sell or lease it to another broadcaster quickly, so that the services could be then rehired by Radio Australia and other broadcasters, all well and good, but nothing seems to be happening.
But what about its television ventures? Because, I mean, there was quite a lot of money put into trying to do Australian television on the same way that, for example, BBC World Service has been doing BBC World and Deutsche Welle with Deutsche Welle Television.
Well, yes, Australia Television started back in the early 90s by the then chief executive of the ABC, David Hill. It's his baby. It went along quite nicely in those days, but of course television is a very expensive medium. And in the end, it got too expensive. The government changed. The Howard government decided that they could not afford to fund it through the ABC anymore. So they sold it off to the Channel 7 network, who now run it. It's basically limping along. And for some time, the ABC provided the news and current affairs. Well, the ABC have now said that they can't afford to do that anymore, and they've stopped that. So I don't quite know what's going to happen to it.
There was a time when it was also carrying very short Indonesian bulletins produced by Radio Australia.
That's all gone. It's a service that's dying. Channel 7 aren't really interested. They've got more problems domestically. And the ABC's pulled out.
Well, in the 3LO archives in Melbourne, which trace 75 years of broadcast history of this ABC radio station, we dug up an interesting conversation about vintage radio. Comedian Barry Humphreys, who's better known in Europe for his characters like Dame Edna and Les Patterson, Australian cultural attaché, appeared on 3LO as Sandy Stone and discussed the past.
I'm a little nervous, listeners, because this is one of my very, very first visits to a wireless station, and it's a bit overwhelming for me, but my confidence is rallying.
I'll try to put you at ease.
It's fascinating, some of the technology you've got here, Terry. It's absolutely an eye-opener to me.
Do you still have the Stromberg Carlson?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Was the Stromberg Carlson just a wireless, or was it a radio?
It was a radiogram.
It was a radiogram.
You know, I don't think a lot of the young of today would know what a radiogram was. But it was a piece of furniture. It wasn't just a wireless. Mm. It was a piece of furniture. It was very often in walnut veneer and sometimes blonde wood in the 1950s, ripple-fronted. Mm. So that if you knocked something over on the top of it, the water would look, presumably, would look rather pretty on its way down. And you could get the radio stations on one side, and on the other side was the record player, which was adapted for microgrooves.
Yes, and in those days, of course, it did actually have the signs of the radio stations on the dial, so that if you were looking for 3LO, you could find 3LO, or if you were looking for 2BL, you could find it. It wasn't not this number stuff.
Terry, you've really put your finger on it there, because in those days, you knew where you were.
Yes.
You would turn a little Bakelite knob, and what a lovely thing Bakelite was, wasn't it?
It was,
and
yes.
The wireless used to have a nice smell as it really got hot, and you'd listen to, you know, a lot of shows. Oh. However, you knew where you were. You'd turn the knob, and the little needle would move along, and you'd be at the station of your choice. If the kiddies wanted to listen to the Argonauts, then you'd put it on 3AR. Now, for some reason, 3AR is the highbrow station and 3LO is the lowbrow station. That's very confusing for people of my generation. But we may be losing a lot of the younger people listening who'd think we're talking a lot of twaddle.
Which they probably were. Sandy Stone isn't real. Arthur Wyndham is. He's a great broadcaster who worked for many years for the ABC, first as a correspondent in Vietnam, and later represented the ABC many times at overseas radio and television conventions, mainly as part of the Asia-Pacific Broadcasting Union. I asked him to recall a few highlights of his many years in broadcasting.
Not too nice to say many years. I've been in broadcasting long before the days even of tape recorder, long before the days of even long-playing records with nothing but wire recorders. It is now divided between AM stations and FM stations. Talkback is the only justification for keeping AM stations going. They can be very influential in forming public opinion, which was never the case 20 years ago or so. They can be enormously influential. But the future is for the FM stations and the AM stations with digitization remains to be seen, and I would be not game enough to try and prophesy what's going to happen with that.
But it must be linked to the content. It's not just the technology. I mean, there's no point just digitizing AM if there's not more interesting programming or a wider range to listen to. People aren't going to buy new sets.
Well, I mean, the radio just becomes one of the small number of components that digitization makes possible, you see. There's much talk about the future of radio on internet. I think, as you were telling me yourself, that you can just sit at your computer and rattle up 140 or 150 radio stations throughout the world. I mean, that's a marvellous opportunity to do that. As I say, I think I'm just prepared to sit back and wait. I have great hope for the future of radio. I mean, I could not do without a radio. And I don't know who really can?
Why? I mean, I know you also listen to international radio as well, bearing in mind, you know, here in Sydney, so many channels on the television channels available. Why on earth do you switch that off and go and listen to the radio in the evening?
Because wherever I go, I can take a very small radio, the size of 2 cigarette packs, and I can listen to any station I want in the world. I can put it in my pocket. I can go on the train and put a little earphones. I can listen to it there. I can take it to bed at night if I wake up. I can whistle up an overseas station or one of the local stations. You're never away from it. I can get the world news immediately in the middle of the night, long before I'm getting up in the morning and find it in my papers or on our radio. It's indispensable and so convenient, well packed and wrapped and all the rest of it. Why would you ever want to do without it? I don't know how we ever got programs on the air. I mean, when I started as a television producer, all of our programs were live, because then there was no videotape either. But in radio, when we were recording mostly on these acetate discs, and the slightest bit of friction around the equipment center, the slightest bit of fluff under the needle, and it would jam and retract. Then we were recording a drama once, and the call for someone to be shot with a gun. And, of course, the sound effects man had this with a blank cap, and every time he fired the gun, the recorder leapt off and retracted, and they had to go right back to the top. Once you muck up one of those acetate discs, it's not like editing with tape on a digital equipment. You had to put on a new disc and start all over again. When we were working with wire recorders, you're about to put a program to air, fully recorded, and you press the button, and the spools turn, and the wire comes off, and you're left with a mile and a half of tangled wire on the floor, which is actually a half-hour program, which is irrecoverable.
Just for people who haven't seen wire recorders, that was a bit like a tape recorder now that you would have, with two reels, but except not tape, but wire. Was steel wire?
Two reels with a magnetized steel wire, which was as fine as the finest fuse wire, but much tougher, of course. And I think it was an extraordinary invention. It didn't last long, because, you know, the time from those acetate recorders to the wire recorders to the tape recorders was lightning fast. The accelerated rate of development from those very primitive things to where we are now was quite rapid, as it has been, of course, in television and obviously is now in computers. Going back to the 78s, if you were playing the Beethoven Ninth, that might be about 40 records, 78 records. But we used to get these BBC and other transcriptions, which were done on 15-inch discs, and they were played at 33 and a third. That meant, of course, you had to remember to change the speed on the turntable. And the same with our acetate recordings of our own symphony orchestras. You had to be very careful to change that speed. And if you didn't, you made an entire symphony orchestra sound like a collection of banjos. And we had one announcer who played a complete work through at 78, which should have been played at 33 and a third. And when he was asked why he didn't pick this up, and he said that same thing. I just thought they were playing this piece on a banjo. But they were idiots also, as well as defective equipment in the early days of radio.
Arthur Wyndham reflecting on his memories of the millennium, going back to the 1940s. Now back to the present.
Stations, please listen to this. Grab a pen. And now a surprise announcement. We're streaming into the next century by closing this one with a contest designed to help audio historians of the future. The New Zealand Radio DX League has decided to collaborate with Holland's international broadcasting station, Radio Netherlands. We're inviting DX and shortwave listening enthusiasts worldwide to participate in a special competition to register the top stories as the 21st century dawns. All you have to do is note the first three news stories being carried on radio and television on January 1st, 2000. You can make it as difficult or as easy as you like. The headlines could be from a local station round the corner
Or you might want to try to hear from a shortwave broadcaster on the other side of the world. All complete entries will go into a prize draw to win one of 21 Radio Netherlands t-shirts we're going to be giving away. Radio Netherlands will also be donating a set of award-winning music CDs for the most unusual entry requiring special effort. It could be for someone who braved bad weather to put up an antenna to hear a particularly rare station. It might be for digging out the weirdest station audible on the internet. But remember, they must carry news, and you must be able to understand enough to submit the first three headlines. Here's what you have to do. On the first day of the new year, tune in to news broadcasts on AM, FM, shortwave, or television, or the internet. The stations can be broadcasting to local, national, or international audiences. Make a list of the following details. The time of the broadcast, worked out in Greenwich Mean Time or UTC. Remember, it must be the year 2000 in the country you're monitoring. The name of the station or broadcaster. The location of the station or broadcaster. The radio frequency or television channel number or internet address, the URL. The language of the broadcast. Then we need brief details of the first three news items carried on a news bulletin aired by the station. Just add your name, full postal address, and preferred t-shirt size. Send in your contest entry no later than 14 January to Media Network Century Contest, P.O. Box 3011, Auckland, New Zealand. Or email to contest@radiodx.com. The results of the Millennium Contest and prize winners will be announced on this program in March 2000.
Well, good luck, and help us keep track of the way the news was at the start of a new century. For we will analyze the most popular stories as 2000 dawns. I'll just repeat the address for contest entries. It's Media Network, Century Contest, P.O. Box 3011, Auckland, New Zealand. And the email is contest@radiodx.com.
Now we're off to Sri Lanka, where Victor Gunatilaka has news about broadcast developments in that part of the world. Victor.
Yes, Jonathan. Radio Sri Lanka, the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation's All Asia service, made a slight frequency change for its 1230 to 1600 broadcast in English to Asia, and the new frequency 9735 kilohertz, 9735, and also frequency change in the 49 meter band, and that's 6075. A third unchanged frequency is 15425 kilohertz.
And also the Voice of America relay station has also started regular transmissions.
Yes, Jonathan, the new VOA Irina Villa transmissions can be heard on 9645 kilohertz, 9645 kilohertz, 1400 to 1800 UTC, and this replaces the 35 kilowatt transmitter from Akala on this frequency, and the new transmitter is a 500 kilowatt from Irina Villa, that's 9645 kilohertz, 1400 to 1800 UTC.
Will the old SLBC shortwave transmitter site at Akala, will that close?
No, not at all, because there are two 300 kilowatt transmitters of the NHK at the Ekala site, which will continue. Well, the 35 kilowatt Voice of America transmissions for the time being have been kept on standby in case there are problems at Irina Villa. But eventually, the 35 kilowatt transmitters might carry some other broadcaster. Now, they have no ideas at the moment.
Now we've come upstairs to the Radio Netherlands Interactive Department, where Andy Sennett is putting the finishing touches to the 18th edition of the receiver shopping list. Andy, how's it going?
It's almost ready, Diana. Last week we mentioned it would be online in a few days, and, well, it will. It'll be online before the weekend, and that's a promise. I'm just finalising the script that enables people to search for receivers.
OK, and you can check it out for yourself at www.rnw.nl. Just click on the direct link on the left-hand side of the homepage. Now, meanwhile, what's happening in the media?
Well, public TV broadcasters here in Europe are breathing a sigh of relief because the European Football Federation, UEFA, has agreed a deal with the European Broadcasting Union for coverage of the European Soccer Championships in Portugal in 2004. And that means that viewers will be able to watch the games on free-to-air terrestrial television rather than having to subscribe to a satellite channel. Only a few weeks ago, the World Football Association, FIFA, decided it would sell rights to many of the World Cup matches in 2002 to commercial operators. Public broadcasters will be restricted to showing games involving their own national teams. So, well done UEFA for thinking of the public rather than pleasing the accountants.
Now, Andy, the decision of the European Union to consider Turkey for future EU membership has had interesting repercussions in the media there.
Indeed, it has, and it seems that Turkey is already set about putting its house in order with respect to the Kurdish minority. On Monday of this week, the Turkish Foreign Minister, Ismail Sem, said that in future the government would not stand in the way of Kurdish language broadcasting. Currently, there are no formal provisions for broadcasting the Kurdish language within Turkey. A number of clandestine radio stations are beaming Kurdish programming into the country, so it'll be interesting to see whether these remain on the air.
So that's similar to what recently has happened in Nigeria. Now back to Europe. For what's the latest situation in Serbia and Kosovo? For I note that you're continuing to update the online media dossier that we started at the end of March.
That's right. In fact, I've just received the latest update from our Belgrade media correspondent, Dragan Stankovic, and he reports some interesting comments by the technical director of Serbian state broadcaster RTS, Milan Topalovic. Mr. Topalovic has announced that after a lengthy reconstruction of its broadcast sites, Radio Belgrade can once again be heard on medium wave nationwide. Due to the fact that it broadcasts with a lower power than before, reception on car radios is said to be still difficult, while reception on ordinary radios is said to be satisfactory, that's according to Mr. Topalovic. And obviously he's referring there to the transmitter on 684 kHz, 684, which used to have a power of 2 megawatts. And by the way, Radio Belgrade is also on satellite again, on a subcarrier of the TV channel RTSSat, which now transmits via the Horizont 31 satellite, located at 41 degrees east.
Right, from the Balkans, let's switch to South America. And you have news of a station closure over there.
Yes, on the 9th of December, government officials in Peru ordered the closure of the Trujillo radio station Radio Libertad, alleging that the station lacked official authorization and was airing clandestine broadcasts. They also informed the station's directors that if the order was not complied with, they would be subject to civil, criminal and administrative sanctions. Carlos Burmester, director of the programme Voice from the Street, La Voz de la Calle, broadcast by the station, and a member of the family that owns the station, pointed out that Radio Libertad has been functioning legally for nearly 50 years, and he demonstrated this by showing the respective licences dating back to the 5th of November 1951, as well as proof of payment for the renewal of the licences for 10 years. And indeed, the station is listed on medium wave 1160 kHz with a power of 5 kilowatts and the assigned call letters OAX2C.
Well, a clear case of freedom of expression being curtailed. Anyhow, I believe there is a new website on that subject too.
Yes, another one is launched in Eastern Europe, Romania this time. It's part of the Freedom of Expression project to monitor and report violations of journalists' rights. Well, that's a bit of a mouthful, so they call it FreeX for short. And I'll put a link to this news site in the Media Network webzine.
Andy, thank you. An interesting development now in the Middle East, where customs officials in Lebanon have blocked the import of $2 million worth of computers containing Intel Pentium chips. Apparently, there's a long-standing law that prohibits Lebanon from dealing with any companies that have connections with Israel. Technically, Lebanon and Israel are still at war. Local newspapers in Beirut reported on December 11th that despite being widely available for more than 30 years, products containing Intel components are now banned from entering the country.
On December the 8th, Lebanese customs officials discovered that Intel was on one of their blacklists for doing business with Israel. Computer dealers are confused because more than 80% of all machines already in the country are thought to be Intel processor-based. And urgent orders placed because of Y2K problems are now stranded at Beirut Airport.
Wonder how they'll solve that problem.
Time for us to go now. We're back in 7 days with more from the world of wireless.
In the meantime, have a pleasant weekend.
Media Network is a Radio Netherlands presentation. Copyright 1999.
Time is running out for the planet Earth.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network program. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.